I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap, and I'm reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. In the words of the introduction to Tenting Tonight, Mary Roberts Reinhardt, in her two trips to Glacier National Park during the early years of the 20th century, well before the park was a popular destination, offers clear evidence of her venturesome spirit. Reinhardt documented these two adventures, led by dude rancher Howard Eaton of Wolf, Wyoming, in the pair of delightful travelogues. Through Glacier Park, 1916, and Tenting Tonight, 1918. Tonight, continuing Chapter 11, Lake Chelan to Lyman Lake. The first day was the least pleasant. We were still in the Railroad Creek Valley. The trail was dusty. Packs slipped on the sweating horses and had to be replaced. The bucking horse of the outfit had, as usual, been given the eggs, and burying his head between his forelegs, he threw off about $1 million worth before he had been on the trail an hour. On that first part of the trip, we had three dogs with us, Chub and Doc, as well as Whiskers. They ran in the dust with their tongues out and lay panting under bushes at each stop. Here and there we found the track of sheep driven into the mountain to graze. For 100 or 200 feet in width, it was completely eaten clean, for sheep have a way of tearing up even the roots of grass so that nothing green lives behind them. They carry blight into a country like this. Then, at last, we found the first arrow of the journey and turned off the trail to camp. On that first evening, the arrow landed us in a great spruce grove where the trees averaged 125 feet in height. Below, the ground was cleared and level and covered with fine moss. The great gray trunks rose to Gothic arches of green. It was a churchly place, and running through it were little streams living with trout. And in this saintly spot, quiet and peaceful, its only noise the babbling of little rivers, dwelt billions on billions of mosquitoes that were for the first time learning the delights of the human frame as food. There was no getting away from them. Open our mouths and we inhaled them. They hung in dense clouds about us and fought over the best locations. They held loud and noisy conversations about us and got in our ears and up our nostrils and into our coffee. They went trout fishing with us and put up tents with us, dined with us and on us, but they let us alone at night. It is a curious thing about the mountain mosquito, as I know him. He is a lazy insect. He retires at sundown and does not begin to get in any active work until 8 o'clock the following morning. He keeps union hours. Something of this we had anticipated, and I had ordered mosquito netting to be worn as veils. When it was unrolled, it proved to be a brilliant scarlet, a scarlet which faded in hot weather onto necks and faces and turned us suddenly red and hideous. Although it was late in the afternoon when we reached that first camp, Camp Romany, two or three of us caught more than 100 trout before sundown. We should have done better had it not been necessary to stop and scratch every 30 seconds. That night the woodsman built a great bonfire. We huddled about it, glad of its warmth, for although the days were hot, the nights, with the wind from the snow-covered peaks overhead, were very cold. The tall, unbranching gray spruce trunks rose around it like the pillars of a colonnade. The forester blew up his airbed. In front of the supper fire, the shadowy figures of the cooks moved back and forward. From a nearby glacier came an occasional crack, followed by a roar which told of ice dropping into cavernous depths below. The little boy cleaned his gun and dreamed of mighty exploits. We rested all the next day at Camp Romany, rested and fished, while three of the more adventurous spirits climbed a nearby mountain. Late in the afternoon they rode in, bringing in their mitts Joe, who had, at the risk of his life, slid a distance which varied in reports from 100 yards to 1.5 miles down a snowfield, and had hung fastened on the brink of eternity until he was rescued. Very white was Joe that evening, white and bruised. It was 24 hours before he began to regret that the camera had not been turned on him at the time. Not until we left Camp Romany did we feel that we were really off for the trip. And yet that first day out from Romany was not agreeable going. The trail was poor, although there came a time when we looked back on it as superlative. The sun was hot and there was no shade. Years ago, prospectors hunting for minerals had started forest fires to level the ridges. The result was the burning over of perhaps 100 square miles of magnificent forest. The second growth which has come up is scrubby, a wilderness of young trees and chaparral, through which progress was difficult and uninteresting. Up the bottom of the great glacier basin, toward the mountain at its head, we made our slow and painful way. More dust, more mosquitoes. Even the beauty of the snow-capped peaks overhead could not atone for the ugliness of that destroyed region. Yet, although it was not lovely, it was vastly impressive. Literally, hundreds of waterfalls cascaded down the mountain wall from hidden lakes and glaciers above, and towering before us was the mountain wall which we were to climb later that day. We had seen no human creature since leaving the lake, but as we halted for luncheon by a steep little river, we suddenly found that we were not alone. Standing beside the trail was an Italian bandit with a knife 2 feet long in his hands. Ha! Come, adventure! Come, romance! Come, rifles and pistols and all the arsenal, including the little boy, with pure joy writ large over him, a bandit, armed to the teeth. But this is a disappointing world. He was the cook from a mine. Strange the way we met cooks floating around loose in a world that seems to be growing gradually cookless. And he carried with him his knife and his bread pan, which was, even then, hanging to the branch of a tree. We fed him, and he offered to sing. The optimist nudged me. "Now listen," he said. "These fellows can sing. Be quiet, everybody." The bandit twisted up his mustachios, smiled beatifically, and threw a position in the trail, feet apart, eyes upturned. And then he stopped. "I start a little high," he said. "I start again." So he started again, and the woods receded from around us, and the rushing of the river died away, and nothing was heard in that lonely valley but the most hideous sounds that ever broke on primeval silence into rags and tatters. When at last he stopped, we got on our horses and rode on, a bitter and disillusioned party of adventurers whose first bubble of enthusiasm had been pricked. It was 4 o'clock when we began the ascent up the switchback at the top of the valley. Up and up we went, dismounting here and there, going slowly but eagerly. For once over the wall, we were beyond the reach of civilization. So strange a thing is the human mind. We, who were for most of the year most civilized, most dependent on our kind, and the comforts it has wrought out of a primitive world, now we were savagely resentful of it. We wanted neither men nor houses. Stirring in us had commenced that primeval call that comes to all now and then, the longing to be alone with Mother Earth, savage, tender, calm old Mother Earth. And yet we were still in touch with the world, for even here man had intruded. Hanging to the cliff were the few buildings of a small mine which sent out its ore by pack pony. I had already begun to feel the aloofness of the quiet places, so it was rather disconcerting to have a miner with a patch over one eye come to the doorway of one of the buildings and remark that he had read some of my political articles and agreed with them most thoroughly. That was a long day. We traveled up from early morning until long after sundown. Up the switchback to a green plateau we went, meeting our first ice there, and here again that miracle of the mountains, meadow flowers and snow side by side. Far behind us strung the pack outfit, plodding doggedly on. From the rim we could look back down that fire-swept valley toward Heart Lake and the camp we had left, but there was little time for looking back. Somewhere ahead was a brawling river descending in great leaps from Lyman Lake, which lay in a basin above and beyond. Our camp that night was to be on the shore of Lyman Lake, at the foot of Lyman Glacier, and we still had far to go. Mr. Hillegas met us on the trail. He had found a campsite by the lake and had seen a bear and a deer. There were wild ducks also. Now and then there are scenes in the mountains that defy the written word. The view from Cloudy Pass is one. The outlook from Cascade Pass is another. But for sheer loveliness, there are few things that surpass Lyman Lake at sunset. Its great glacier turned to pink, the towering granite cliffs which surround it dark purple below, bright rose at the summits, and there, lying still, with the stillness of the ages, the quiet lake. There was, as a matter of fact, nothing to disturb its quiet. Not a fish, so far as we could discover, lived in its opalescent water, cloudy as is all glacial water. It is only good to look at, is Lyman Lake, and there are no people to look at it. Set in its encircling, snow-covered mountains, it lies 5,500 feet above sea level. We had come up in 2 days from 1,100 feet, a considerable climb. That night, for the first time, we saw the northern lights. At first one band like a cold finger set across the sky, then others, shooting ribbons of cold fire, now bright, now dim, covering the northern horizon and throwing into silhouette the peaks over our heads. Chapter 12. Cloudy Pass in the Agnes Creek Valley. I think I have said that one of the purposes of our expedition was to hunt. We were to spend a day or two at Lyman Lake, and the sportsmen were busy by the campfire that evening, getting rifles and shotguns in order and preparing fishing tackle. At dawn the next morning, which was at 4 o'clock, one of the packers roused the big boy with the information that there were wild ducks on the lake. He was wakened with extreme difficulty, put on his bedroom slippers, picked up his shotgun, and still in his sleeping garments, walked some 10 feet from the mouth of his tent. There he yawned, discharged both barrels of his gun in the general direction of the ducks, yawned again, and went back to bed. I myself went on a hunting excursion on the second day at Lyman Lake. Now, theoretically, I am a mighty hunter. I have always expected to shoot something worthwhile, and to be photographed with my foot on it, and a bearer, whatever that may be, holding my gun in the background. So when Mr. Fred proposed an early start and a search along the side of Chihuahua Mountain for anything from sheep to goats, including a grizzly if possible, my imagination was roused. So jealous were we that the first game should be ours that the party was kept a profound secret. Mr. Fred and Mrs. Fred, the head and I, planned it ourselves. We would rise early and, armed to the teeth, would stalk the skulking bear to his den. Rising early is also a theory of mine. I approve of it. But I do not consider it rising early to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. 3 o'clock in the morning is late at night. The moon was still up. It was frightfully cold. My shoes were damp and refused to go on. I could not find any hairpins, and I recalled a number of stories of the extreme disagreeableness of bears when not shot in a vital spot. With all our hurry, it was 4 o'clock when we were ready to start. No sun was in sight, but already a faint rose-colored tint was on the tops of the mountains. Whiskers raised a sleepy head and looked at us from Dan's bed. We tiptoed through the camp and started. We climbed. Then we climbed some more. Then we kept on climbing. Mr. Fred led the way. He had the energy of a high-powered car and the hopefulness of a pacifist. From ledge to ledge he scrambled, turning now and then to wave an encouraging hand. It was not long before I ceased to have strength to wave back. Hours went on, 500 feet, 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet above the lake. I confided to the head between gasps that I was dying. We had seen no living thing. We continued to see no living thing. 2,000 feet, 2,500 feet. There was not enough air in the world to fill my collapsed lungs. Once Mr. Fred found a track and scurried off in a new direction. Still no result. The sun was up by that time, and I judged that it was about noon. It was only 6:30. A sort of depression took hold of us all. We would keep up with Mr. Fred or die trying. And then suddenly we were on the very roof of the world, on the top of Cloudy Pass. All the kingdoms of the earth lay stretched out around us, and all the kingdoms of the earth were empty. Now, the usual way to climb Cloudy Pass is to take a good businesslike horse and sit on his back. Then, with frequent rests, the horse takes you up. When there is a place the horse cannot manage, you get off and hold his tail, and he pulls you. Even at that, it is a long business and a painful one. But it is better, oh, far, far better, than the way we had taken. Have you ever reached a point where you fix your eyes on a shrub or a rock 10 feet ahead and struggle for it? And, having achieved it, fix on another 5 feet farther on, and almost fail to get it, because if you have not, you know nothing of this agony of tearing lungs and hammering heart and throbbing muscles that is the mountain climber's price for achievement. And then, after all, while resting on top of the world, with our feet hanging over, discussing dilated hearts because I knew mine would never go back to normal, to see a ptarmigan and have Mr. Fred miss it because he wanted to shoot its head neatly off. Strange birds, these ptarmigan, quite fearless of man because they know him not or his evil works. On alarm, they have the faculty of almost instantly obliterating themselves. I have seen a mother bird and her babies, on an alarm, so hide themselves on a bare mountainside that not so much as a bit of feather could be seen. But unless frightened, they will wander almost under the hunter's feet. I dare say they do not know how very delicious they are, especially after a diet of salt meat. As we sat panting on Cloudy Pass, the sun rose over the cliff of the great granite bowl. The peaks turned from red to yellow. It was absolutely silent. No trees rustled in the morning air. There were no trees. Only here and there a few stunted evergreens, 2 or 3 feet high, had rooted on the rock and clung there, gnarled and twisted from their winter struggles. Ears that had grown tired of the noises of cities grew rested, but our ears were more rested than our bodies. I have always believed that it is easier to go downhill than to go up. This is not true. I say it with the deepest earnestness. After the first 500 feet of descent, progress down became agonizing. The something that had gone wrong with my knees became terribly wrong. They showed a tendency to bend backward. They shook and quivered. The last mile of that 4-mile descent was one of the most dreadful experiences of my life. A broken thing, I crept into camp and tendered mute apologies to Budweiser, my horse, called Buddy, although he was not the sort of horse one really became familiar with. The remainder of that day, Mrs. Fred and I lay under a mosquito canopy, played solitaire, and rested our aching bodies. The forest supervisor climbed Lyman Lake. The head and the little boy made the circuit of the lake and had to be roped across the rushing river, which is its outlet. And the horses rested for the real hardship of the trip, which was about to commence. One thing should be a part of the equipment of everyone who intends to camp in the mountains near the snowfields. This is a mosquito tent. Ours was brought by that experienced woodsman and mountaineer, Mr. Hilligoss, and was made with a light muslin top 3 feet long by the width of double-width muslin. To this was sewed 3 sides of cheesecloth with double seams and reinforced corners. At the bottom it had an extra piece of netting 2 feet wide to prevent the insects from crawling under. Erecting such a shelter is very simple. 4 stakes, 5 feet high, were driven into the ground, and the mosquito canopy simply hung over them. We had no face mask, except the red netting, but for such a trip a mask is simple to make and occasionally most acceptable. The best one I know, and it too is the woodsman's invention, consists of a 4-inch band of wire netting. Above it, whipped on, a foot of light muslin to be tied around the hat, and below, a border of cheesecloth 2 feet deep with a rubber band. Such a mask does not stick to the face. Through the wire netting it is possible to shoot with accuracy. The rubber band around the neck allows it to be lifted with ease. I do not wish to give the impression that there were mosquitoes everywhere, but when there were mosquitoes, there was nothing clandestine about it. The next day we crossed Cloudy Pass and started down Agnes Creek Valley. It was to be a forced march of 25 miles over a trail which no one was sure really existed. There had, at one time, been a trail, but avalanches have a way in these mountain valleys of destroying all landmarks, and rock slides come down from great cliffs, fill creek beds, and form swamps. Whether we could get down at all or not was a question. To the eternal credit of our guides, we made it. For the upper 5 miles below Cloudy Pass, it was touch and go. Even with the sharp hatchet of the woodsman ahead, with his blazes on the trees where the trail had been obliterated, it was the hardest kind of going. Here were ditches that the horses leaped. Here were rushing streams where they could hardly keep their footing. Again, a long mile or two of swamp, an almost impenetrable jungle, where only the woodsman's axe marks gave us courage to go on. We were mired at times, and again there were long stretches over rock slides, where the horses scrambled like cats. But with every mile there came a sense of exhilaration. We were making progress. There was little or no life to be seen. The woodsman going ahead of us encountered a brown bear reaching up for a cluster of salmon berries. He ambled away quite unconcerned and happily ignorant of that desperate trio of Junior Reinhardts bearing down on him with almost the entire contents of the best gun shop in Spokane. It should have been a great place for bears, that Agnes Creek Valley. There were ripe huckleberries, service berries, salmon and manzanita berries. There were plenty of places where, if I had been a bear, I should have been entirely happy. Caves and great rocks and good cold water. And I believe they were there. But 31 horses, and a sort of family tendency to see if there is an echo anywhere about, and such loud inquiries as, "Are you all right, Mother?" and "Who the dickens has any matches?" These things are fatal to seeing wildlife. Indeed, the next time I am overcome by one of my mad desires to see a bear, I shall go to the zoo. It was 15 years, I believe, since Dan DeVore had seen the Agnes Creek Valley. From the condition of the trail, I am inclined to think that Dan was the last man who ever used it. And such a wonderland it is, such marvels of flowers as we descended, such wild tiger lilies and columbines and Mariposa lilies, what berries and queen's cup and chalice cup and bird's bill. There was trillium, too, although it was not in bloom, and devil's club, a plant which stings and sets up a painful swelling. There were yew trees, those trees which the Indians use for making their bows, wild white rhododendron and spirea, cottonwood, white pine, hemlock, Douglas spruce, and white fir. Everywhere there was mountain ash, the berries beloved of bears. And high up on the mountain there was always heather, beautiful to look at, but slippery, uncertain footing for horse and man. 25 miles, broken with canter and trot, is not more than I have frequently taken on a brisk sunny morning at home, but 25 miles at a slow walk, now in a creek bed, now on the edge of a cliff, is a different matter. The last 5 miles of the Agnes Creek trip were a long despair. We found and located new muscles that the anatomists have overlooked. A really first-class anatomist ought never to make a chart without first climbing a high mountain and riding all day. It was dark when we reached our campground at the foot of the valley. 100 feet below, in a gorge, ran the Stehekin River, a noisy, turbulent stream full of trout. We groped through the darkness for our tents that night and fell into bed more dead than alive. But at 3 o'clock the next morning, the junior Reinhardts, following Mr. Fred, were off for Bear, reappearing at 10 after breakfast was over, with an excited story of having seen one very close, but having missed it. There was no water for the horses at camp that night, and none for them in the morning. There was no way to get them down to the river, and the poor animals were almost desperate with thirst. They were having little enough to eat even then, at the beginning of the trip, and it was hard to see them without water, too. I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap. I've been reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Reinhardt, which was republished in 2002 by Riverbend Publishing, Helena, Montana, in cooperation with the Montana Historical Society. Bookshelf is a feature of Spokane Public Radio. Vern Windham and Nancy Roth, executive producers, producer Caitlin Maroney.